production of Dirty Mo Media. The Dale Jr. Download. Hey everybody, it's Dale Jr. back again for another episode of the Dale Jr. Download. My co-host Mike Davis is here. How's it going, Mike?
Going great, bud.
Awesome. We got a great guest coming into the show. Jason Schultz is here. Leah is here. And Ward Burton,
yeah, I know.
Finally, is coming to the Dale Jr. Download. So it's going to be awesome. Ward's here, so let's get started. Man, I'm anxious to hear his story. You remember when we had Jeff Burton on here?
I do.
And the whole time we're talking to Jeff, he's telling us Ward stories.
That's right.
So let's hear it from the man himself. Ward Burton, coming into the Dale Jr. Download.
Ward Burton of South Boston, Virginia.
Ward, the oldest of the two Burton brothers on the Winston Cup circuit.
Off turn four, Ward Burton scores his first Winston Cup win.
Ward Burton, careful.
Who comes to the caution and white flags and wins the Southern 500.
Everyone on their feet at Daytona, some 170,000. As South Boston, Virginia's Ward Burton comes to the line, and Ward Burton is going to win the 44th Daytona 500.
I can't believe it.
Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Ward Burton were racing for 12th spot. Now Ward's in the wall.
Ward, what happened?
I got some really good words for him, but I can't say it on TV. But
you sent a nice message, though, with the throw.
I wish I had something like a shot through the window.
There he is. Wow. Come in here with a lot of energy.
Hey, man. How's it going?
What are you doing, Ward?
Man, I've been traveling to see y'all this morning.
How long was the trip?
Well, it's supposed to have been 2.5, but I didn't get a ticket, so it was 2:15.
Nice. You still got it.
Yeah. He still knows where the
still
gas pedal is.
Still got the speed.
Yeah.
I still can tell the ones that don't know where their rearview mirror is.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You look good, man. You look healthy.
Man, I stay busy. Dale, yeah. I run from dusk to dark every day. I was in the workout room this morning at 4:30 and feeding the dogs and the horses and getting in the shower and hauling butt down here.
What is the motivation to stay in such good shape?
Well, you know, started working out racing.
Mm-hmm.
But, golly, I just had such great role models growing up with a work ethic. So if I don't feel like I'm accomplishing and doing every single thing I can every day, then I don't feel right here. So yeah. I'm just driven, man.
You and your brother are so different, all right? What is the deal? Like, why you and him don't seem like brothers to me? But y'all did. Y'all were together a lot. Y'all spending a lot of y'all's, you know, y'all raced together at South Boston. I don't know what y'all's life was like around the house when you're teenagers. But why are y'all so different from each other?
Well, look, I'm gonna tell you something. I talked to Jeff last week. If I think of something three or four times, I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to think about how I'm going to deal with it. I knew that you and I were going to be talking about this today because I saw a little bit of the interview with Jeff that y'all did last year. And I called Jeff just because this kind of spurred it a little bit. And we had a great conversation. First thing I told him is I didn't feel like I'd been a really good older brother.
Mm. Really?
And I told him I loved him. And I do. And I love my brother Brian also. But we had the greatest parents in the world. I mean, back in the 70s, you know, when I was growing up, and even in the late 60s, had a lot of freedom. You know, my freedom was staying in the woods. And you got to envision, my mom was Brian is 3 years younger than me. Jeff is 5.5. So, you know, with mom taking care of those two, that gave me a lot of freedom to go out and just be a kid in the outdoors. But Jeff's growing up was a little bit different than mine. You know, I took the hard road, so I got sent away to a bunch of schools during the summer school, during summer.
I got what kind of schools?
Reading, speeching, writing, English, you know, and be honest with you, if I was sitting in a classroom, I was interested in what was going on outside, mm-hmm. outside in, of the woods, not in the classroom. I just didn't get it, and I didn't realize that I needed to do what was expected of me and then take the easy road. I took the hard road. And that made me get sent away to military schools and all this.
What military schools you had to?
Hargrave.
We used to go to Hargrave and play basketball. I was at Oak Ridge. So Oak Ridge.
Well, we have rival military schools at the table. Who knew?
There was, I guess, a bit of a rivalry, but Hargrave is the real deal.
Yeah.
Now, Oak Ridge is a way easier. Hargrave, when we'd go up to Hargrave, it was scary.
So this is the way when I was at Hargrave 3.5 years, graduated second lieutenant, there were some military schools we could go to. They were sharp, like Fork Union. They were sharp. Hargrave was sharp. And I'm not saying anything about it.
Sure.
The other ones would be slack where you could wear your
yes.
clothes hanging down and all that. Not at Hargrave. You're going to walk the bull ring.
Yeah.
But anyway, Jeff and I just had a different upbringing. And I had some grand older role models. So I was really close with one of my granddads and my grandmamas. My dad, you know, we spent a lot of time together in the outdoors. But I had some other older gentlemen, particularly C.R. Sanders, that taught me a lot about land stewardship and just taught me a lot of lessons. So he was like a second dad, a granddad, and a dear friend all at one. That started at this tall. So my roots were really deep. And when my parents separated, man, and we all...
How old were you when that happened?
I was in college. So Mom called me and told me she needed me home. I knew it was coming. But Jeff is 16. So y'all know, everybody, there's no perfect family. My mom and dad were perfect parents, and I was and still feel that way today. But when they split, it obviously affected Jeff a lot more than me.
Hmm.
And so, you know, when I was brought up, I was made to go work in construction because that was what my granddad founded, my dad run. It was like a family farm, you know. What do you do at a family farm? You go work and pull your weight. Well, I realized real quick when Jeff got to that age, Dad did not make him do that. So it gave me a little bit of an attitude. Why the hell does he get to stay, you know, do something other than work? But Jeff worked really hard, and, you know, his racing career, you know, Dad gave him the opportunity. I think a lot of the reason that Dad did what he did for Jeff at that age and not Brian or I is Dad felt guilty of why the family split up.
Huh.
And, you know, and then as later, Dale, later as when I got into street stock and, you know, I went to a race to see how they were doing and my career, you know, it wasn't – Dad wanted to see if I was focused. And after a year or so, he realized there was nothing else that was going to come between me and that race car after work. But anyhow, you know, I'm proud of Jeff, and, you know, I've got two great brothers. And we just had different upbringing, man.
Yeah,
in the same house, but different upbringing.
Wow. So
why the hell do I talk different? Jeff said I was from the southern end of the house. I don't know.
Yeah. He did say that. So he started racing first. All right, and so how old is he, I guess, 18?
Well, when
you where college did you go to?
I went to Elon.
All right, and what did you finish?
No, sir.
So how many years did you go?
I went 2.5 and didn't know what I was going to do in my life and called my buddy C.R. Sanders that owned that 1,100 acres that my foundation owns now is protected and went and lived in the woods 2 years.
Right after college?
Well, he quit. You left college.
I went home and my parents were like, it was my second year, like, what are you going to graduate in? And I said, I'm going to major in philosophy. It just came easy to me. Dad said, you're not going to make a living doing that, son. You got to have business. So I went and took a business economics course during the summer. Didn't go very well. I called my buddy Sanders, can I stay in this tobacco barn?
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I wanted to go to something that I knew I felt at peace at, and I just didn't know where my life was going. And being outdoors, I'm at peace, I'm self-reliant, and that's what I needed.
How far was this from the house?
It's about 30 miles from.
Did you tell your dad and mom that you were going to go live in this shack?
Well, I didn't have a vehicle.
You have a car?
So you really sort of disappeared from civilization then when you say you
moved
out in the woods.
Well, I did, but look, we had some hellacious time back there in high school with friends, so I still had company on a weekend.
Yeah, you still had some visitors.
They knew where to find you.
But a normal week, you know, I'm trapping and hunting and doing what I got to do to provide food for myself.
All right, so you're doing all that, living in the woods, doing everything. This is exactly what you want to be doing.
Yep.
And what was your dad had an opinion about your major in college. What was his opinion about this decision to be in the woods for 2 years, trapping and doing all that?
Dad and I relationship kind of got strained a little bit when my parents split up. Me being the oldest, seeing what it did to my mom and my two younger brothers, it took us a few years to get past all that. Yeah. Some of it was me, some of it was him. So when I decided it was time for me to kind of get back in the real world and start working again, you know, I went right back to J. Burton Construction, renting a house like I always did. And,
hold on. So you went to the shack for a couple years. I call it a shack. It's not really a shack.
It's an old tobacco barn that Sanders had put
a rock floor in.
That's it, man. I just restored it a couple of years ago. Yep.
What's inside it when you was there?
It's a rock floor with that chimney and two old World War II bunk beds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much it.
That's it. And you didn't have a car. No. So how did you get to the store? He didn't go to the store.
I didn't need anything at the store.
Where'd you get your water at?
Creek down below. That's where I bathed at, too.
Really?
Yeah.
And you ate everything. You went and killed and hunted and trapped for everything you ate.
Pretty much. I mean, you know, look, it wasn't like I was living in the middle of British Columbia in an igloo.
Yeah. Did you? What'd you do?
So I had some sugar and some flour.
I was just going to ask you, did you season the meat?
Man, back then it stayed cold enough. I could bag a deer and leave the hide on it and gut it and go out and carve what I wanted and put it in some Reynolds app and put it in the coals.
What? Yeah. Was that cold?
It froze from like mid-December into February. And if it thawed, it didn't thaw like it did. Yeah. Down like it gets 70 one day. So, yeah, that's...
Okay. Yeah. So how did you stay warm?
The fireplace.
Oh, so because it had a fireplace in it. Yeah, all right. Wow, you really did live off.
It's
the
pretty
land.
Awesome.
I didn't know if you maybe snuck a couple runs to Cracker Barrel or something like that. Maybe
well, there wasn't any Cracker Barrel. Hey, man, you know, I went in town some. You know, hell, if it, you
did
know,
you?
Bar hopping or whatever. You know, look, I'm single, man.
Did
so, you? Know,
yeah, you raised. So you was raising a little hell in there every once in a while.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Jeff told me you were. he said he wouldn't. You know, he did party a little bit.
It was, and you got to remember, man. It's, you know, I was brought up in the '70s.
Yeah, right.
It was a different world in the '70s.
So, what made you decide? All right, it's time for me to go to work.
I don't know. I think the biggest thing I was at peace. Mm. I had done what I felt like. I don't even know if I really consciously gave it any thought. I knew where my soul was at, and I've always been at peace in the outdoors. And I just, you know, I didn't do well in college. I didn't know what the heck I'm gonna do in a livelihood. I just needed to unwind a little bit.
Yep.
And then when I came out, I still didn't know. I just went back to work, and I always had my own place.
Yeah.
Were you and your dad still? Did y'all mended whatever little
fiction
there was?
Yeah, we started spending more time together, and of course, you know. Just like me, the worst attribute anybody can have, and I can have no patience with it, laziness. So, Dad, you know, you at the office at 7 a.m., and you work till 3:30 those days. So, you know, I'm going to be prompt. I'm not going to be late. And, you know, that started. Dad's seeing, okay, he's got his blankety-blank together.
So, how long after that did you drive your first race car?
Well, I drove Carl Long's Daddy Horns' Volkswagen twice.
When?
I'm thinking that was 85.
Were you in the cabin or were you out?
No, I was renting from a...
You'd been out for a bit?
Yeah,
year or two?
Probably a year.
Okay.
I'm guessing.
Was your brother racing?
Yeah, so Dad took Jeff straight from go-karts to late model stock. And
he's got this red number 12.
Yeah.
He's working on that and over at the house.
And racing those guys back in them times, Bugs Harefield, yeah. Wayne Patterson, Maurice Hill, they were the best in the country, yeah. man. So, I mean, they were kind of floundering at best.
Yeah.
You know, and Carl offered me that, or Mr. Long offered me that Volkswagen. I just said, shoot, I borrowed a fire suit. And then a gentleman named Carl Newble was putting together an old street stock. It was an old sportsman car. And we went out there, and I can remember them straightening the snout with a chain and a pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
But we qualified third and took the lead in, I don't know, it was 30-lap feature. Lap car got in my way, almost spun out, finished second. But after that, everything else was second. You know what I mean? The outdoors, the girls, the party, and everything came out after that race car.
Yeah.
That's something. That's a big change then.
Well, it's a hobby, and I'm still working for Dad, but I'm driven as soon as I get off work to whenever it is. You know, you did the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's what you did, man.
Yeah.
You know?
You went and worked on the race car.
Yes, sir.
So you ran that street stock a year? Or
year and a half.
Year and a half.
Yeah.
Same car.
Year and a half.
Same car.
Same car, yeah.
Working and working and working away.
Yeah.
And your brother's racing his late model.
Yeah.
I saw a video on YouTube of you racing a Camaro.
A yellow one.
Yep. Whose was that?
That was Goo Fallon. So Goo Fallon, he's passed years ago, but
how long had you been racing when I saw that video? What part of
year and a half.
You've been running a year and a half.
I've been running that street stock, so that's 85. So you know, I'm 25 years old. Yeah.
So you just still pretty green.
Hell, I hadn't raced anything since go-kart.
And in this video, I didn't know if you'd been running late models for 4 years or whatever, but so apparently you just run the street stock for a year and a half, and then you get in this yellow Camaro.
Goo built me that car, number two, so yeah. Two, right?
You won in that video, and it appeared from watching the video that it was your first win.
With the late model.
With the late model.
Yes, yeah, you're exactly y'all was right.
You're in pit road, so the other classes are still running. Y'all run y'all's race, and
right,
you won
that's
it,
right.
And y'all were drinking out of a champagne bottle. You remember that?
Well, I remember Jeff finished second. And Jeff, man, back in the end, so Dad hired the Rice brothers, Chris Rice's daddy and uncle.
Yep.
They were the first full-time late model stock crew on the East Coast.
Yep.
It eventually changed the whole spectrum.
Yeah, I'd say it did.
It really did. And Jeff and them, I mean, they were bad to the bone.
Once they teamed up.
Yeah.
And you beat them that day.
Well, there was a big wreck in front of us. The only reason I got the lead, I went through the grass and come out the other side with the lead.
Yeah.
So
you take it how you get it, right?
Hell, heck
you
yeah.
You ain't giving the trophy back, are you?
No, that's right. We called that car the crab because it either run really good or wouldn't run at all.
Yeah. So yeah. What was that feeling like, though, at that point in your life when you started racing after your brother raced? And I know I'm not trying to think y'all were in a competition or anything.
Fine.
But you won a race. You started after him, and you weren't in late models as long as him, and you go out there and get in that car, and you show yourself as a winning driver, like you can do it. Are you thinking in your mind – I know you're probably not thinking about cup racing and how far you're going to go in this deal, but you got to be pretty proud of yourself.
Maybe a little bit. You know, look, the minute I got in that street stock, the 77 street stock, I drove the wheels off that damn thing. They were tough enough that I could bounce off the wall and not even knock the toe end off. That really, and I bet you Jeff would admit it right now, because they were floundering in late model. When Jeff saw me going out there and started winning races in this street stock and all, it got his program up.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, really, that first day, I can remember going back to the Dad was building Best Western. And, you know, whether it be the plumbers or the concrete guys or whatever, all the subs, or the people that I'm digging ditches with, everybody's looking at me different.
Yeah.
Because I had just gone over there. Didn't win the race. I finished second, but I drove the hell out that damn car. And they looked at me different. And I was like, you know, what's different about today?
Mm.
It was just the fans packed the races back in them days. And they looked at me like all of a sudden I was a different guy just because I wheeled a car. But
that's nice.
I think it helped. I think me getting in there helped Jeff get more motivated and more aggressive as a driver. Because I was always the most aggressive, and Brian was the best between us both. And Jeff, we could get to the end of the race at the same place, right? I'm wanting to lead the first damn lap. Jeff was fine to take his time and get there at the end. Yeah. Kind of like, you know, the old, like what you always hear about David Pearson, how good he was versus some others that, you know.
Isn't that interesting, though? Is like one more thing that they are just completely different than each other, even all the way to the how they approached racing, you know, back then. Now, did you just say Brian also raced? Was he?
My brother Brian was the best of both of us. So, look, Brian had my aggressiveness, but Jeff's level-headedness and put them together. So Brian would get the lead by the middle of the race. I'm going to either wreck or win the race on the first lap, and Jeff would take his maybe too much time.
Yeah.
So Brian was an awesome go-kart racer.
Did he run any street stock or late model?
No, Brian was at college at that time, and, you know, it was just all a hobby. But I tell you, Brian created on the third and fourth turn, he called it the Brew Crew.
Yeah.
So, you know, Brian and all of our friends, they'd be lining up the stands and turn three and four at South Boston every weekend.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He had his own fan.
And there was always a party somewhere. Yeah.
What was the chassis on that Camaro? I just got to know. Is it a stock front clip?
That was a manual Savakas.
Yeah.
Out of Richmond.
Okay.
You remember Butch Savakas? Yes. You ever? Yeah. Yep. Yeah, Butch was a good racer, too.
Yeah.
Emmanuel used to say, I'm the highest paid stopwatch in the garage. You know, people hired him for cup cars and all that. He's all I do is use my stopwatch and tell him what to do.
Hey, everyone. Dirty Mo Media President Mike Davis here. Excited to tell you about one of our newest sponsors at Dirty Mo, Airbnb. The irony here is that Airbnb is new to Dirty Mo Media, but Dirty Mo Media is not new to Airbnb. It has been accommodating us for years. And if you are a race fan, and I think you are, you know why. I mean, you've booked hotels at during a race weekend. The prices are insane. You're stuck with these unreasonable multi-night minimums. Whereas Airbnb, you got many choices all within proximity, and it ends up being way more affordable. Now, I'm not only a frequent Airbnb guest, but my wife and I are also Airbnb hosts. And you should be too. We've been doing it for years. I'll tell you why. We have an investment property that we realized it could be earning additional income through Airbnb. You don't have to have an investment property to do that. You could just find extra space in your home. That works too. It all could be making you some extra cash. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So how long did you run late models?
Let's see. So I stopped driving for Goo probably in 86 or 87, drove for Dad. Dad built two cars for me, Hitchcock cars. I'm guessing 88, 89, something. Then, you know, Humphrey Wheeler created the sports division.
And so that's what you got into?
Yeah, and that was awesome, man, because, you know, you just found these old, not Bush cars, but the sportsman cars, and put our late model motors in it. And I really did really well there and knew, man.
Where'd you get your car? The sportsman cars are always the interesting thing about the sportsman cars is they were ex-Xfinity cars, or they had a pass, some pass somewhere.
They had a pass.
This Nova, Dad built this car in 84, and it won at Daytona, Rockingham, Charlotte, Darlington.
Really?
In 84, 85, 86. And then he built him a Monte Carlo with a new Monte Carlo body, and that car went and ran a sportsman series at Charlotte.
Wow.
And they cut the back up and put a 9-inch rear end housing in it. I mean, a quick change in it, you know, and it did. They wrecked it. It's been destroyed front and back in that series over there. So, but that's an example of like all those cars had a past. Do you know where your car came from or how you acquired it?
Bobby Temple owned the car.
Who's he?
He was in racing years ago, and I don't know how to answer that. I haven't been in touch with him in a while. Dad and I drove somewhere in Eastern Carolina, and if I'm not mistaken, it was somewhere near Cary. And this car had every kind of junk stuff on top of it and everything else in the garage, and he finally got all the stuff off of the damn car. Anyway, it was green lime, and we got our motor on it, so we didn't set it up or nothing.
Y'all got this car from that guy.
We didn't get it. It's his car. We took him the motor, and he said, my crew helped a little bit. He said, we'd like to meet y'all at the racetrack.
Wow.
I mean, really. And to be honest with you, we had a radiator leak, so didn't get but one lap practice, but set the baby on the pole.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And led every damn lap and we cut a left rear tire down with like 8 laps to go. Jack Sprague, Todd Bodine was in the field. Mm-hmm. I tell you what started happening. People realized they could go get these cars for fairly cheap. And so after the second race, we're getting ready to do the third race. One guy got killed. He had spun out off of 4. And the guy that hit him was going into 1. So the caution light. But, you know, it's just the guys that listen, look, there was a few that started racing, didn't have no racing experience at all, but wanted to go race Charlotte. Yep. And that's what ended the whole series.
When they let Tom Benfield, what was his name? Henry Benfield.
Henry Benfield.
They let Henry Benfield run one of those races. Yeah, he had no damn business being on the racetrack, and he'll tell you that. I was young, and that series was pretty awesome.
It was awesome. Yeah, well, you know what's interesting? So I watched part of a tape on that first race. Your dad was helping. Oh, his crew chief was running the race.
Yeah, Shamardine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So your dad was on the radio with him, and it was funny because Jeff Bodine was helping Todd. You know, so a lot of the Cup guys were getting into this race, man.
Yeah.
So you dropped all of your late model stuff to go to run that car?
No, we're still running late model.
Okay.
I'm just saying that, to me, that was a big break for me because people
got to see you.
Yeah.
And so what came of that? Like you go run, you sit on a pole, lead all them laps.
Nothing much came of it. I tell you what, you know, really, how I went from late model to Busch was dad was helping Jeff with Sam Ard, you know.
Yep, Jess is driving Sam Ard's car at White 12.
That's exactly right. You pretty good.
Man, I'm a historian, buddy.
I can tell.
Yeah.
Well, Ed Faree.
Ed and his orange 49, orange and white.
Exactly right.
That's a good-looking car, a Buick.
Well, Ed told me, he said, if you come up to, I think it was Delaware, I've got a car that I'll let you run.
Hey.
So I went up there with my bread truck and my open trailer.
We were talking about this in the Darlington garage the other day.
Yeah. I mean, the bread trucks were awesome.
Yeah.
You had all the room in it. But anyway, Ed Faree and his wife, I mean, they were just fabulous. And
so what'd he have?
He had a motor and a car and let me take it home. It was white. I think we put 12 on it. I can't remember. But we went to Martinsville with the Glass Brothers and Bill Smith and Danny Bomar. They used to help Tommy Houston years ago. I mean, Tommy Ellis. But anyway, we didn't make the race by time, but we won the heat race. Mm-hmm. And I think we finished 12th in the feature. Little did we know that we needed to add a lot of forward bite to those cars. But anyhow, man, that was a big deal for us.
Yeah.
And after that, you know, around that a few years, I met Mike Swain. And Mike Swain and Morgan Shepherd and I shared the Texas Pete 9 Busch car.
Dang.
Oh, yeah.
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 So, I mean, really, the Ed Faree doing that, and Dad was still helping me at the time. So, look, I mean, back on that, Dad certainly helped Jeff more than me, but just like I told Jeff the other day, if it hadn't been for my dad, neither damn one of us would have had the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know? You know the deal. If you're going to show your talent, which that's what got you rides back in them days, somebody had to give you opportunities.
How did the ride with the Texas Pete car go, that 9 car?
Man, it was awesome. I mean, golly. So
I remember, sorry to interrupt you, I remember going to the races and seeing, like, damn, there's a different guy in that car every week.
Yeah.
It was wild. I didn't know I was young, you know, and I didn't understand why there were different people in that car every week. But did you know going into the season what races you were going to run, or were they calling you early in the month saying, hey, we need you to?
I knew.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to remember. I don't think it was the full schedule. I'm really not sure. I can't remember, but, you know, like I had Charlotte and Gainesville, South Boston.
When you went so you'd already ran the sportsman car around Charlotte, so you weren't too worried about you'd been, you know, coming from a mile and a half south or a half mile south Boston track to a big track like Charlotte. You already run the sportsman car around there, so you kind of you weren't going in, you weren't stepping into something that was too big for you.
Man, I always felt like back before they did all the paving, if I had a good car, I owned Charlotte. How many races that we lost from lug nuts or running out of gas or tires? Not that I didn't make some mistakes, too. I mean, in all three divisions.
Yeah.
I mean, out of all the places, how in the hell I don't have some trophies at Charlotte? I love that place. But, you know, we went to Charlotte to test the Texas Peak 9 car bikes. And Mike was on the way, and me and Rick Wren, you remember Rick Wren?
Yes.
Rick Wren could make me go, man. Mm. Rick Wren could make me haul the mail. We ran two laps, the fastest lap there. I spun out off of two, got in the wall a little bit. So I had some body damage. So testing's over. Later that day, Mike was like, "Well, you know you ran the fastest lap of everybody, right?" And I said, "No, I didn't." But I was a little irritated with myself. And anyway, we went back, and that was really before the Bush guys on the mile-and-a-half track could run with your dad and Harry Gant.
Yeah.
If you go back and watch that race, I ran with Sterling Marlin, Harry Gant, and your dad's car really wasn't good that day. But we run in the top 5 to 7 all day. And the Tommy, nobody did that back in them days. Anyway, your dad gave, we had a late restart. Your dad knocked the hell out of me going into 1 and 2. Got me up, I think I was 4th or 5th, and I ended up finished 7th or 8th. But that was a big break for me. So that led into the next year of getting with Charlie Henderson, then eventually getting with Mr. Dillard.
Charlie Henderson?
Yep.
What car was that?
Charlie Henderson was number 75.
Oh, the Food City.
Food City.
Yeah.
Food Country.
Food Country.
Food Country, yeah.
Yeah.
Heck of a nice guy.
That car had been in the series for a long time.
Long time. Yeah, heck of a nice guy. You know, poor thing, he just didn't have the right people around him, yeah. But heck of a nice family. And
then you got into the Hardy's deal.
Yeah.
With the 31.
Well, it was Gwaltney then.
Gwaltney, the 27.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
And that team was around a really, really long time.
Yeah, because, you know, Mr. Dillard used to be a really good racer himself.
Yeah.
But his son-in-law was Rick Mass.
Yes. And then, yeah.
Yeah, so they
– He helped Rick.
Yeah, he started fielding cars for Rick.
Yep.
And then when they split up
– He did his own deal.
Elton Sawyer was driving for him before, yeah.
Like McMurray drove that car, the 27. I mean, the ownership thing kind of moved and changed a little bit and shaped around a little bit, but that 27 stayed in the series till I got there. Like, same sort of organization.
It wasn't Mr. Dillard
at
the time.
No.
Yeah.
You won Rockingham, though, right? And it was like
with the Gwaltney.
In 1992? Was it around there? Like, was that your first Bush win?
Yeah, 91 or 92.
And so what are you thinking then? I mean, when you're winning now at the at this level, are you when do your sights set for the big time? Have you even allowed yourself to get to that point yet?
You know, I never really was concerned or given a lot of thought to cup cars. But, you know, I knew like what I had done at Charlotte. You know, all it was Rick Dennis and Mike Swain and Rick Wren and me. That's it. That's the team.
Yeah.
And so I knew if I had the opportunity, you know, golly, I passed up so many rides. I mean, at 93, who you drove for called me and wanted to know if I wanted to run some cup races.
Who? Rick?
Rick.
Yeah.
Rick Hendrick called you in 93 to run cup?
Well, it wasn't full time. He said, "Would you like to run some cup races for me?" Well, I was ecstatic, and I called Mr. Dillard, and he wasn't happy at all about it.
Because y'all had a good thing going at that point.
We did, and, you know, hell, he had I mean, so when I got to racing for Mr. Dillard, I didn't have to work construction no more. You know.
Right.
You know, I'm full-time racing, so, yeah. You know, I don't, man. It's, you know, going back, if I look over those things, I think I could have had a whole lot more wins. But it's just, you know, I had to just tell him no, because Mr. Dillett was really, and I think some of what it was, what him and Rick had been through, you know, his son-in-law, so I don't know, just.
So that didn't work. So what other rides did you get that you turned down?
I don't even know where I'd start.
You got a lot of them.
Yeah.
Well, hold on. But that's cut. We're going to get to that in a second. Cause then,
we are.
Because in 93, you win three more. I mean, now you're still winning that number, that Hardy's car.
Yeah, so Gwaltney pulled out. I was lucky enough to meet Randy Pritchard. He ran Body Knoll that owns a bunch of Hardys in Virginia and North Carolina. So they were the sponsor in 93.
And you're still running for Dillard.
Yes, sir.
And then you go to Cup in 94.
Yep.
But this is going to Cup with Dillard. Right.
Right.
I remember when y'all went to Charlotte and qualified on the pole with the Cup car.
Yep.
Flying.
Oh, man, we had that baby hooked up.
Unbelievable.
The next day is when the right front tire, that was my first real blackout from a concussion.
Yeah.
Oh,
you know, where I knew who I was. Mike, you could walk in there, and I would ask you the same. This is what they tell me. I'd ask you the same three questions. Or Dale, you walk, ask you the same thing. But if you walked out and came right back in, I didn't even know you had come, had been there.
Yeah. Mm.
And then all of a sudden, not the light bulb was fully bright, but all of a sudden I came back and I was released. That was Dr. Petty. Dr. Petty did a such great job for all of us when we would get hurt. You know,
he did. He's retired.
Yeah.
I remember that car, that race, and how fast you were. So, you know, guys come into the series, guys come into NASCAR, come into the Cup Series. There's new guys coming in every year, rookies, and everybody pays attention to the rookies. And they have to do something. They got to do something, right, to stand out. And that was your moment, I think, where we had been watching it I'm young, but we had been watching you in the Xfinity Series. But you popped on the scene there and put that car out there on the pole, and everybody was like, "Dang, this, you know, you weren't." It was a brave moment in my mind watching you qualify that car because you had no fear.
Have you ever had one fast enough? I never have. I ain't never sat in a car that couldn't be better.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah.
So, I mean, nobody's going to – back – and, you know, when the sidewalls started changing and becoming so stiff, this technique didn't help me. But even when I didn't have the best car, nobody was going to outdrive me in the damn corner.
Yeah.
That just won't happen. But, you know, as that evolution started changing, that wasn't helping me any with it. Yeah.
Okay, so now, Hendricks offered you a job. You turned it down. But then you're released from the 31 – in 95, after 21 races, it says here, and this opens the door for Bill Davis, I'm assuming. But, like, at this point, you're turning down rides?
Well, so look, Mr. Dillard, like I'd already said, gave me my, you know, it was the first time I'm driving for a living. It was a rough start, you know, so we missed, in 94, we missed Daytona, we missed Rockingham, we made Richmond by like a tenth of a second, the third race. Mm-hmm. Freddie Fryer had left at the end of 93. For whatever reason, him and Mr. Dillard just couldn't work it anymore. So we didn't have any leadership. But then all of a sudden, Philippe Lopez and Ronnie Crook came on board as a pair. Those two guys have made a huge input in the sport, way beyond what we did together. But once they got there, look, we had – that was back when you mounted the body. I don't know the measurement. Let's say it's 32 inches. That's what you run at Daytona, and it's 34 to down. Every car we had was 32 inches.
Mm. Oh.
So you remember what I'm saying, the way they mounted the body? So, I mean, we just – it took them a while, but I feel like we did a lot with very, very little. We finished second at Pocono. You know, we did set on the pole at Charlotte. That last race at Atlanta, if you watched that race at night, we were going to win that damn race. The motor blew with, like, we're done with pit stops because we're going to lose spots in the pit. We're done with everything. We got fuel. We're leading the race. We're going to win it. And blew a motor. So with very little, we were doing a lot. Even the day that Mr. Dillard needed to fire me, because he knew I was going to leave. I was going to finish the year out, but he knew I had to leave. We finished sixth at Michigan. I mean, that was a few guys, and Mr. Dillard, God bless his heart, he spent a pile of his own money
yeah.
keeping that thing running. So, I mean, it was tough.
But he knew you had to leave because you were due your chance to be in a better ride.
Well, it wasn't just that. It was, man, I mean, he didn't have enough funding for sponsorship.
Got it. Right.
So Hardy's was a good sponsor, but they wasn't that good. Remember, Hoosier was in the sport in 94, so he got free tires. They wasn't in 95. So just that bill alone, you start adding them up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's tough, man.
So you got a call from Bill Davis. How did that conversation start between you and him?
George Debonart had called me. And so I'd already met with George and Bill and Gail and Dave Elgino of MBNA. We'd already had some conversations. And, man, I mean, shoot, that 95 Pontiac with the shape of that body and Chris Hussey in the team, we missed North Wilkesboro. But other than that, I mean, it was just solid, man. And it's just a really – Bill Davis, that's a really small team. I mean, just a real small shop. It's nothing like you got right here. And it was working that year.
Did you remember, when did you start noticing Bill Davis? Was it before Ward started driving for them? Because that's when I first started noticing Bill Davis.
I think it was when Bobby was driving for him a little bit.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Because I guess the curious thing for me was the Maxwell House sponsorship left Juniors and went to Bill Davis with – Bobby, I think so. And I think I was like, well, who's this Bill? Who's this? What? And they, you know, Bill's team came from the Xfinity series with Gordon. So everybody was kind of aware of Bill, and he was moving up and moving out of the Xfinity series where they'd had a lot of success with Jeff Gordon and Mark Martin. And so you were kind of paying attention to seeing whether he could make it in the Cup Series as an owner. I mean, he had a great reputation.
There was a lot of friction, you know, when Jeff left.
Yes. He was mad.
Yeah.
Because he felt like that Ford and him had this, agreement that Jeff was going to.
Right.
They were all doing this together.
Right.
Right. And then Jeff left to go to Rick's, and right. Bill was like, well, damn. I'm going to have, you know, so the next thing in line, I guess, was Bobby.
And Randy LaJoy drove for him, too.
Yeah. Is that right?
I think Bobby had already left the year before when I got there, if I'm not mistaken.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So how did you and Bill Davis get along? I mean, were you happy? You're now driving for Bill Davis.
You was there a while.
We got along well. I always felt like open communication. Bill wasn't very good communication when there was an issue. If there's drama, to me, that's when you got to be the best communicator. And if you think of something three or four times, how you deliver it is important, right? But that's when you have to communicate the most. And I always felt like that was a big weakness, because if there could be an issue here or there, and you know, it was just tough for Bill to talk about it. And consequently, sometimes things would get worse.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Was he not? He didn't like confrontation?
Some of it was that. And it's just, you know, at the same time, it's kind of like what we talked about with Jeff and I. On Bill's perspective, what was going on behind the scenes, I'm sure there was a lot of times it was some financial crisis that he wasn't talking about. I mean, there was quite a few times he would tell me this or that, and he would owe me X amount of money for driving. I'd just say, well, keep it, just trying to help. So, yeah. I mean, you know, I wish that if I could go back and do things over with Bill, I should instigate more positive communications, because I mean we came a long way staying together to a certain point, and then, you know, once technology got there, when the sidewall of Goodyear tires started changing in 01, and you know, shortly after that, man, it became an engineering game, and that meant resources had to be a lot deeper.
Yeah.
And you know, it was a tough road.
What was your best year, you think, with Bill?
I would say running consistently in 2001.
Yeah.
Because the mile and a half, I mean, I loved the mile and a half. Tommy and I were really doing well. When we went to Rockingham to test in 01, put in a stiffer right rear spring because I couldn't get the nose to turn and tighten the car. Tommy was yelling at me, and we had the little bit of telemetry on there that showed, you know, brake, throttle, steering input. It showed 4 degrees more steering input, which obviously is tighter, right? Mm-hmm. He went and put the spring on the spring tester. Well, what was going on? We were keeping the damn spoiler in the air. Well, there's no way I know that, and he sure didn't know it either. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what started to change, where you needed technology. Just the grassroots guy throwing stuff at a car and fixing it didn't fix it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you and Tommy now had some success. I mean, you win the Southern 500 at Darlington in 2000, or 2001. You win the Daytona 500 in 2002. You and Tommy, I mean, I don't know what it, from the outside looking in, I mean, I don't know how the Virginian and the New Yorker, the dynamics of that relationship, because I, you know.
Communication gap.
Like, I don't know how that resolved.
It was great,
from
man.
Success, from on-track success, you guys had it. And then you go win Daytona 500, obviously.
So when Tommy first came on board, you know, look, I'll tell you this story. Chris Hussey made me haul freight in 95. Changed the body style. I don't know what the heck else changed, but we just lost it somewhere. We still had Poconos and Charlottes, and I could name a bunch of races that we just flat gave away. Couldn't even see the second place car. I mean, we got the only way we're going to lose a race is to give it away.
Mm.
But we lost our consistency. I look back on it, and this was something that, you know, I bet you Bill would do it over. I mean, MBNA, Charlie Carley told us, and I felt like we were in the principal's office, he said, if you find another position for Chris Hussey on your organization and you give this boy a new crew chief, I'll be the highest damn paid sponsor in the garage.
Mm.
And Bill didn't do it.
Damn.
He did not do it. So eventually, in the latter part of 98 is when they made the switch. Our second race at Charlotte, we finished second with Tommy and I. So Tommy was aggressive, man. I can remember Bill going to Arkansas one weekend, and Tommy started cutting the bodies off of the cars. He's trying to get some downforce, you know. And Bill come back and was kind of freaking out. Well, it paid off at the racetrack.
Yeah.
You know, just because this car looks real pretty, it doesn't mean it might be, might not, it might could be improved. So Tommy just was aggressive, man. He brought Jimmy Ryland and a bunch of guys with him. It just pumped the team up.
Yeah. What do you still recall when you think about the 2002 Daytona 500?
I was wanting to know if you knew what you'd done when you win. You know,
no.
Do you know what you've
no.
even done?
No. Did you when you won? No. See,
I was happy. I was – my emotions and a happiness about it, I think, matched the moment. But I don't think
right.
I realized how special that was. I probably didn't appreciate it.
So you're labeled, for better or for worse – when you introduced Dale Earnhardt, Daytona 500 winner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when it sinks in?
Yeah.
Oh, it's time. It's years
what you are.
Before it really sinks
oh,
in.
Oh, is that right?
Did it do you, Dale?
Yeah. I mean, I think I probably about 5 years after is when I really got to where I thought, damn, I'm so glad I won that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I remember being wrecked out or something broke or whatever, but I wasn't in the race. And
there was a big wreck.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So
took
I was,
right out.
But I remember watching y'all come around the track and y'all running the top, and there's about 10 cars in the lead draft with you in front of it, and I was thinking, damn, he's gonna win this race. You know, I just couldn't believe it.
Hold on a second. The thing that happened. Speaking of the wreck, remember that's the red flag where Sterling Marlin
pulled on his fender,
got out
yeah.
of his car.
He had yeah. a fast car.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
But he
well,
put
look,
you,
so,
but it put you up front, and you know when he made that mistake, he was leading the race, I think. And he got a little contact in that caution.
But when I have to go back and look at Daytonas in 01, we had the baddest hot rod there. We led the most laps. It would have been a different outcome of you and Mike, was all I can say.
Yeah.
Oh, if you had been up there?
I mean, yeah, because I was passing Tony Stewart by myself on the outside, and they were the next two.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying Michael wouldn't have won. You know, all I can say that I was going to be a player.
You're going to be in the middle of it.
My car was bad. It was handling and it was cheated up. And I'm not going to go tell you where. It went under the hood, but I mean that thing was hauling the freight.
Yeah. Wait a second. This is a safe space. You didn't know that? Like, this is where people come and tell about all their cheated stories.
I didn't know there was any safe space.
It was cheated up. At least he said that.
We just did a podcast with Andy Peterman, and he unloaded. He told us everything.
I did.
It was awesome. Yeah. You remember that car that Harry Gant won four in a row? It had all kinds of things going on, he told us about.
Well, we had so the floor firewall. I'm going to say who. The floorboard on the car, we had welded an extra layer of floorboard. Mm-hmm. And the only way you're going to tell it if it somehow or another flipped up and gotten torn all the heck. And anyway, we went to Talladega. I don't know why, but every single thing we touched made the car better. Even if I got a penny, if I'm walking and I'm acting like I'm pushing the car, and I stuck a penny up under the left top windshield and put that penny in there, it was a half a tenth. Every time it was a half a tenth. Anyway, but my mindset on the 0-2 is I have to miss the big wreck.
Yeah.
And we wasn't handling good, but Harvick blocked Gordon going into 2.
Yep.
And that's probably the wreck you got into.
Yeah.
And, man, if you look at the tape, I turned it just enough not to spin out, and I bet you I missed a 29 by that much.
Mm.
And I come on the radio, I said, we just got our chance. Yeah. And then Tommy made some last adjustments on the last stop. My car was handling. So we had worked our way up to third. Say, hey, man, you know, you got to be somewhere in that position to win those races back in.
Yeah. Where's that trophy?
It is in my basement. I went to British Columbia and somewhere around 03 or something. I don't know when it was. And my wife hired an interior decorator and took all my stuff out of storage and put it in a basement wall like this. So I'm kind of embarrassed when I bring a guest over because it looks like a Ward Burton shrine. Now I'm trying to put Jeb's stuff covering my stuff up.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
You could have said that trophy got turned into a deer feeder and none of us would have been surprised.
No. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
We've got to talk about Bristol.
Oh, yes.
which race we're going to talk about?
Well, did he have it coming? That's all I want to know.
I didn't do anything.
He didn't.
Did he have it coming?
I never paid him back.
He never did.
Oh, so he still got one coming.
Appreciate it, Mike.
All right, let's set this race up. Who wants to go first?
I don't know. We was running along middle of the race or something. I don't know when it was in the race, but we was running about 15th or 20th, and
we were in the top 10.
Were we?
Yeah, hell yeah. We'd been in the top 10 all night.
All right. We're running along. Well, we're running, and I'm trying hard to get by Ward, and the cars were pretty even. And if you got to run, it was kind of a thing at Bristol, if you got to run on somebody, it wasn't a big one. You wasn't going to get a big run on nobody. We all run around the bottom of the racetrack. We hopped up out of turn two. It was pretty fun back then when the way you run turn two, you kind of clipped the apron a little bit. And if you did it just right and the guy in front of you didn't do it the way you did it, you might have an opportunity because his car would kind of hop up out of the corner and your car would keep turning. And I had a run up to his bumper, and I think I had about 3 inches. And he went down. We went down in the corner, and he's coming down. And I was
arcing the heck out of it.
I was like this. Yeah. I was like, we're gonna hit, and we hit, and it spun him out, and he hit the fence, and he was mad. He should have been mad.
So when you came back around on the caution laps, were you surprised when you saw him down on the track?
I mean, I was like that never had happened to me before where somebody was that mad at me. Because I hate conflict and hate arguing and fighting, and I was just disappointed in not in him, but when growing up with dad and growing up son going to the racetrack, right? I respect all the guys that dad raced. I respect them like they're his, you know, maybe they're his friends or they're, you know, I don't want to do anything that's gonna make them mad. I wrecked Dale Jarrett at Watkins Glen, stupid, just ran over him in the carousel, and he come up to me. we went to a test at Bristol the next week, and we pull in, and I think it's just a tire test or something. And I pull into the track, and my hauler's on one side of the track, and Dale Jarrett's is on the other. And I was like, oh, shoot. And, I mean, I ain't been there 5 minutes. And he come in the hauler, and he goes, did I do something to piss you off?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, this is terrible. This feels I feel terrible. Because, I mean, I respect this guy, right? And right. I done messed this up. Now I done messed up that I want his respect, and I done messed it up. And so that was kind of the same feeling that I had with Ward. And because we always had raced good and stuck my nose somewhere, I guess I shouldn't have put it.
Well, did you see, so when Jeb started driving for you and Kelly and Joe Maddox and all.
Y'all did a deal. Y'all did, you talked about it. Is that yeah. what you
well,
talk?
tried to make it happen a year or two before, but what I was getting at, I felt like, you know, particularly your name is Junior Motorsports. I felt like that I should do something. Because, I mean, people remember Dale and I, you know, having this.
The highlight.
Yes. So I did a thing on social media. Have you seen
it? I saw it.
And, you know, I just winged it. That was my first take. And I'm sitting there with this phone doing a selfie, which Jeb has influenced me to do. Anyway, that what I said what I meant. You know, you look.
It was nice.
Hey, man, you know. I've made a bunch of mistakes on the racetrack, and, you know, I've had people probably wreck me more than I wrecked them. And, I, you know, at the end of the day, was I mad? Was I madder than mad? Absolutely. But I went up to you in Richmond. I said a little bit of something to you, but it wasn't confrontational, and, you know, I knew that you didn't mean to wreck.
Do you remember that? Mm-mm. Oh.
I just went up to him, and I said you should have called me. He said, well, I didn't know what to say, which was an honest.
That's true.
And I said, just be truthful. And I walked off.
I didn't know why you didn't throw a helmet. Why did you throw your
helmet,
gloves at
I like
him?
My helmet. If I can get a helmet to fit, the last thing I'm going to do is mess that helmet
Ward,
up.
But if you're going to send the message, oh, man. Ain't nobody going to change your throwing gloves at him.
I mean, hell, I wasn't. Well, if my car would have cranked up, that 8 car wouldn't have finished. I can tell you that. That's how pissed off I was.
But you had a chance. I mean, you raced.
Get him mad. No, damn. No,
I've always wanted to ask this, though. But you raced with him the next week. How long did you carry that?
Oh, I don't forget. But I owed a lot more to his dad than I did him. I mean, really, that's the only conflict. Dale and I raced. I don't know of another time. We might have rubbed a little bit, but I don't remember another time that I was at all irritated at Dale about what he'd done on a racetrack.
Yeah.
But you had several with the senior?
Well, I could go into it. We could have a whole show just on that, but, I mean, which drivers didn't?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever throw anything at him, though?
You can be as honest as you want to be about my dad in this room. We let him have it. So
we throw gloves.
Yeah.
Well, let me just say this. If I wrecked the 3 car, you're going to get booed. You're going to get hate mail. It's long before social media, right? If the 3 car wrecks me, it's just racing.
Yeah.
That's just the way it was, man.
Jeremy Mayfield moved him out of the way and lived to tell about it.
Well, I mean, heck, I caused a big wreck at Talladega, 2000, I think.
Yeah.
I hit my left front got on the apron. So Dale's, you know, we all holding each other, Dale. He didn't do anything wrong. My left front, that was before, that's when they put the line down there so you can see the line after that. And anyway, it got me loose. And I got into the left rear of Dale. And that's when Dale got hurt. He got burnt some, Bill Elliott. And the next week, you know, when I got out of the car, immediately they said, what happened? I made a mistake. I caused a wreck. And no lie, for four to five weeks, I would get booed at the grandstand. But more importantly than that, I think we were in California the next week. And I'd gotten Bill Simpson I'd gone to a full-face helmet finally, and he cut my eye ports back because before he was like this, and yeah. I wasn't going to do it. And I went into your dad's hauler and showed it to him because, I mean, Bill was really good. He could fix belts or helmets, and I could see. I got my peripheral visions. You know, I could see my hands there, and I'm not going to drive something that blocks it. But I went in there and told your dad again I was sorry, and he called me back that day because I had called him. I think I waited till Monday just to say I was sorry. I called y'all's office. I think he was on the bulldozer doing some work at the farm.
Probably.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, we had a bunch of history. I come out the end of it the other way more times than not. But
Well, so we can finally put the Bristol thing down at least to rest.
Hey, but man, you know, at the end of the day, this gentleman here sitting at a table with me, and I thank you for having me here. After your dad passed, I mean, I can't imagine not only with everything that was going on, all the dynamics with your family, but, you know, you had the whole sport on your shoulders. I mean, you really did, and how you handled that and still do is amazing. I mean, there's not a lot of people that could have done what you did. I mean, you know, back in them days after that happened, the half of the stand was red with Budweiser shirts or hats. I mean, to carry that load, man, you did an amazing job. You still do.
Well, I appreciate that, man. I mean, it's I think the reason why I wanted to do as good as I could was because of you guys like you, you know, the Ward Burtons, Bob the Bonnies, Dale Jarretts, all those people that I raced against, and I wanted y'all help me, you know, not even directly, but indirectly help me get from week to week, and showed me how to act, showed me how to handle, you know, myself in and around the race car in the garage and after races and in interviews and all that stuff. And I still leaned on you guys. And
well, I wasn't there much for you, you know, because, you know, look, I had a racing life and I got this whole nother life. And it's always been that way with me. Racing gave this other thing that's my full-time life of voice. So, you know, I wasn't much there for you. I'm just saying, you know, it just, however you did it and continue to do it, you did an amazing job, because that's a hell of a lot of pressure, man. You know, that is. I don't care who you are.
So I want to get back to going to race for Haas CNC. You left you left Bill Davis and went to drive.
Well, he fired me.
Bill fired you.
Yeah.
How come you got fired?
Well, so Bill got caught building Toyotas, and I got the phone call from a top guy with Dodge at Dover that they were dropping the support. That was 2002. So, I mean, crazy thing, man, we won two races in 2002, but everything unfrazzled.
Mm. Wow.
Everything fell apart. Baldwin got fired shortly after. They got caught building Toyota trucks, and the following year, you know, I had in the contract that if they released me for any reason other than medical reason or whatever, that I'd get 10% of the deal. And Bill came to me one day, I remember being under the car, and said, you know, I don't feel comfortable with that. I think I ought to take it out of the contract. And I said, you know, okay. Well, within 6 months, I get this letter in the mail. They hand me a letter at the shop. So, I mean, you know, when I look back on it, I don't really know who was influencing who back there, but I'd stayed there for the right reasons to look after those people. But
you were at the shop and got a letter?
I was at the shop, and a gentleman that worked for Bill named Mike Brown handed me an envelope, and I read it on the way, and it was them basically wanting to release me.
Up until that point, had you had opportunities to go to other teams?
Oh, hell yeah, man. The 28, the 99, the 18, I could keep naming them.
The 99, the one that your brother ended up in?
I gave Jeff that ride.
How'd that happen?
Well, because Buddy Parrott and I were trying to get Buddy Parrott to come to Bill Davis. And then Mark Martin got with me at Watkins Glen and wanted to start another team with Jack, obviously, and you know, again, Bill had done a lot for me at the time, and Buddy decided, and he called me and said, look, I think the best opportunity for us to go with this Ralph's deal. And I don't know, man. You know, George Devonart, Dave Elgina, Charlie Carley, Bill Davis, I mean, a lot of people had helped me get the 22 car, and I just wasn't ready to look after my own self and drop all them. So Jeff called me. I told him who to call.
When they eventually dropped you, how'd that make you feel?
I've learned a lot. So I am still loyal as a little puppy in the yard. I just probably not got blinders on as much as I did. Yeah, so, I mean, if you're my friend, man, I got your back no matter what.
But you felt betrayed then?
There was, look, at the end of the day, again, like we were talking, I don't know what was going behind the scenes. So I'm not here to judge anybody. All I know is I did what I was going to say that I was going to do on all cases. I'm going to follow the code that my conscience tells me to do, and I'm never going to vary from it. I'm just not going to do it.
There's just so many drivers that do things so differently in those situations, you know what I mean? And there's drivers like you that are loyal to a fault, and then there's the guys that jump at every opportunity and it don't, and they leave anything in the wake. That's just crazy.
I'm just a country boy from Halifax County, Virginia, you know, and I've just been always taught to, this is what you do. I would have liked to have had some people around me, even with Mr. Dillard, you know, when Gibbs was calling Chevrolet about that opportunity, how I could structure things so it's still maybe take this opportunity, but still be able to
not turn your back on the one you're in.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I tell you, somebody I always thought did a good job of that with Dale Jarrett. You know, like it was. The way he left the Wood Brothers to go to Robert Yates, you know, or it may have been Joe Gibbs at that time.
Well, yeah, it was.
But you know, it's just I needed some people I can confide in. As I look back on, I just didn't have anything like that.
Was that Zero car? They were sort of in between drivers at the time. Was this a good opportunity and only opportunity, or what?
It was the only opportunity. My stock was down. I mean, we hadn't run very well.
Yeah.
And Tony Furr was a heck of a good guy. I mean, at the time, Joe Custer literally didn't know a damn thing about cup racing.
Yeah.
You know, so he was trying to do it for Gene Haas. Once Tony Stewart got in the ball with that, I mean, it was just a ball game changer.
But yeah.
Really, they couldn't figure out how to use the Hendrix resources, you know, so... And after that, you know, I got to the point I didn't know who to trust, and I just put the helmet in the closet.
Mm.
I
quit.
Did you want to quit?
No, I felt like I was in my prime, man. I mean, even today, I feel just as good as I did when I was 18. I felt like I was in my prime, and I just wasn't going to fight the battle. Really, the biggest thing is just who I could trust and who I couldn't.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I've always looked after myself. Hell, we all have to, right? But I've always looked after others as much as myself and still do.
So you got out of that car. You end up coming back in 06 and 07 and running in that four car for McClure a little bit. They come across to me as a fun group. I don't know how fun it was at that particular point. their business ended up closing up. But
right.
They were always kind of – they did it a little different. They weren't a Charlotte-based team.
Right.
And they ran out of Virginia and – Anyhow, I have to wonder, did you, when you stopped driving and you still feel like you had so much left in the tank, how were you able to stay away from the seat? Like any seat, right? You could have raced with your son. Did you race with your son? He's trying to get going. He runs some late models over the last decade.
Yeah, later. I mean, Jeb was still quite young then.
I know.
And it probably affected
you. You look like you could get in a late model now and go to Ace or somewhere and run top three.
Man, you know what I did? So, you know, I always had this other life. Even when I was racing, when I wasn't racing, I was doing work on Sanders Farm or I was doing some outdoor activity. Then when I started my foundation, I mean, little did I know I was creating another child. I mean, literally. So by that time, you know, I created the foundation in 96, man, that was an emotional roller coaster, particularly the first 10 years. I mean, I had a lot going on while I was still driving. I was doing at least two full-time jobs.
Yeah.
So for me to leave it, I had a whole nother life. It was already established. I mean, who I was and the what I was taught as a kid, it was already instilled in me. So I knew, I mean, racing was an occupation. This is a lifetime endeavor with outdoor and giving back and trying to leave the world in a better place. And so I've been so driven on that. Do I dream about it, or particularly those first few years? Absolutely. I mean, was it easy for me? Yeah, because if I'm stressed, I become less stressed if I'm working and I'm busy. My calluses are going to stay on my hands. So, you know, that was my release, and I've been driven ever since. So did I give it thought? Do I feel like I missed a lot of opportunities? Absolutely. But I didn't have control of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Does Jeb's success, which congratulations, by the way, because I also know how hard you've worked, you know, and Jeb winning that race this year is just, man, we all love that one. But did Jeb's success pacify also a little bit of maybe what could be that urge that, you know, of the way that you – and you've always got the woods, but also Jeb is now doing quite well.
It's completely separate.
It's just you're able to compartmentalize all that.
It's completely separate. Look, the decisions I made for my career were mine and mine only. Yeah. And the one that I had no control over, I didn't have any control of it. So, you know, if something goes on with our conversation today that I didn't have control of, I'm not going to give it a whole lot more thought.
There you go.
You know what I mean? What I did, I did it.
Yeah.
And the decisions I made, I made. So, yeah. And were some things thrown at me that I wish hadn't have been? Absolutely. That's just life,
it's
man.
Life.
Jeb's career has been much different than mine because everything is much different. If you look at what Jeb did in 2012 in the Turner truck, he would have been offered a bus ride the following year had Dale and I been doing that 15, 20 years later. Because there was 30 or 40 car owners with sponsors in the garage. And that's why the phone used to ring. And does talent still mean something? Absolutely. But y'all know somebody's got to be behind somebody. And a lot of times there's funding associated with it. It's just the whole thing has changed. So all I know with Jeb, it's been, man, I don't know how many times I cried or in despair or happiness over it. I mean, it's just been crazy. I mean, when Cherokee Tobacco, which was an e-cigarette, which was sponsoring then Turner Scott, they left Daytona the fastest truck, and I get a phone call. And after that phone call, trying to figure out how to fix it, I didn't leave my office for 8 days other than go take a shower. I was so stressed out, you know, so a couple of years after that, I finally just said to Jeb, look, I can't carry it on my shoulder solely no more. I cannot do it. It's going to kill me. And other things that need to be getting done aren't being getting done. And be honest with you, son, they don't want to talk to me anyway.
Mm.
They want to talk to you. You're the driver.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after that, it started clicking. And Jeb, you know, I'm proud of him. Whatever happens in a racing career, the kid's got a work ethic. He treats everybody right. He's not got any unspoken motives. He literally, if you were his partner, he literally wants you to succeed as much, if not more, than him. And that's all you can ask for somebody, you know.
Yeah, he works hard, man. He's the example of what you really want out of a driver when outside of the seat. You know, he's great in the behind the steering wheel. A lot of them are. But what he does outside of the car, not a lot of guys are doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know he has to work hard to get these opportunities he's got. But when he does get those opportunities and he gets the partnerships like what he's got with Colleague, he still has that same pressure, you know, intensity.
That's right.
Of his social media. I follow him on social media and all the work he's doing there with all the various partners that he's got.
Right.
All the stuff is on brand. You know, it makes sense. It seems to connect to what he is and who he is.
Well, thank you.
He does a really amazing job, and I think he's a great example for guys when you're trying to show a driver, like, hey, man, you know, I know you think if you win this race, it's going to click, but you got to do these things too. You got to be this guy every day, not just on race day.
That's right.
And Jeb's amazing when he's outside of the car, one of the best examples that we got. Of a driver doing what he needs to do. What are you doing every day? Like, what are you trying to accomplish with your foundation? So I see you're on social media fixing beaver dams and and holding snakes. But what are you trying to accomplish? What is your goals?
Well, so, you know, it's why I'm wearing this right here. I can help one of my children, right? Mm-hmm. So if somebody sees I want to represent Colic Racing and Nutrient Ag Solution, my goal, other than my children, is to my foundation to be able to live on after I'm gone.
And what does your foundation do?
So we're a conservation organization. And we're all about proper land stewardship, which the foundation owns almost 10,000 acres. Mm. And we manage that for Pacific species, from forestry to wetlands to we got some endangered plants. And every one of those acres is open for veterans and youth outreach. Mm. And I got a great staff and a bunch of volunteers. So I don't know how many hours, but it's a lot of hours of letting and providing services to a lot of the guys in the military has given so much. We run a program called ACUB, Army Compatible Use Buffer, for two National Guard bases. And so we got a contract with the National Guard, and that's to protect, like if this base is this circle, that's to protect the outskirts of the base so that the men and women can get the proper live fire training. So it could be an Abram tank. It could be a drone, dark skies. It could be small fires. It could be mortars. It's a lot of stuff going on. And these two bases are two of the top training bases in the country. That's been a blast. I mean, before I came in here, I was just talking to a gentleman named Dave Widnick. It used to be a colonel. He's second in command of Fort Union Town Gap in Pennsylvania. And to be able to work with these majors and colonels and these civilians, they got their act together, man. They're true Americans who care about not only our freedoms, but the men and women that are providing those freedoms. So, you know, from there to our youth outreach, I mean, we really focus on four things, and that's Army Compatible Use Buffer, proper land management, youth outreach, and all the all those put together where we got a lot of outreach. We're getting ready to build a facility that's just for a landowner and youth and veteran outreach, which would be a shooting, a 3D archery, fishing, and some axe throwing competition. We're building a pavilion. So, man, we're just trying to give back.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the foundation and the big picture, we've helped conserve directly or indirectly over 60,000 acres with using tools like conservation easements that's available for all landowners that the landowner can economically thrive from making a perpetual decision. So, you know, it's all about just giving back, you know, mm-hmm. and I want that foundation to live on after I'm gone for all the right reasons. So, really, Dale, I'm working on things that's a heck of a lot more important than me.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Do you think that that Jeb has that same passion to carry the foundation beyond your lifetime?
Jeb has done so much to help us with his partners. All of his partners support us in some way or another. You know, he's learning. I did not move to Charlotte, which probably hurt my racing career because I wanted to raise all three of my kids in the rural culture. And I already had such a longing because I told you about C.R. Sanders and that 1,100 acres. I already had such a ground and I couldn't leave. But, yes, I think, you know, time will tell, but he's got all the tools, and I think he's definitely got the passion, yeah.
Where was it when Jeb started showing leadership or entrepreneurial prowess? In just tell this story of the motorhome lot when he was a kid, because I've always wanted to know if Ward knew what he was doing behind the scenes.
I found out later.
When Jeb used to come and get your autograph.
Yeah.
And then go sell them.
Go sell them at the...
You don't remember this?
No. You're looking at me like I told this story
myself.
You have
told this story.
It was Dale and
it was
Jeb
Dale
Gordon.
Jr.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jeb, as a kid, and honestly, I didn't mean to dilute your message about all this great stuff you're doing with your foundation, but like Jeb... When I realize how awesome of a worker he is and how much leadership potential, I still have this in the back of my mind where he, as a kid, he used to go into the bus lots into the motorhomes, knock on doors, get the drivers to
autograph. That only happened one time, Mike. And Brandon McReynolds was involved with it, too. Yeah, they both were doing it. So they're selling y'all's autographs. And once we found out, it's like, no, that day.
I can't believe you don't remember it, because I remember being in the bus and him knocking on the door and you signing it.
Oh, you were in the bus.
You did this. You signed the thing, and then you went, I know what you're doing.
I did.
Really? Were you there?
Yeah, and yes, and he was making some money off of it. So the question was, did you know that was going on?
Not till later, but that was the
How much later?
It was that evening.
Oh, okay, so that day. Later.
It was after practice.
Okay, so were you impressed? Or are you mad?
No, I wasn't.
He probably wasn't too happy.
Well,
if I can imagine.
First of all, they were in the heck out of Dale. That was in Dale's heyday, right? The whole sports, really. I mean, what are we talking about earlier? Why in the heck are y'all going over there? Word the hell out of Dale.
It was more than just Dale, though. Like, there was others.
There were others. But, I mean, man, so I caught the very end of it, Dale, yeah. And there was a line forming.
Yes.
That wanted your stuff. A line foreman, they wanted Gordon stuff.
And Jeb was out there, and he had to have been...
He like, created some
eight
demand?
Eight or ten. Oh, he had a whole thing, a business going on at the fence line.
It's a pretty good idea, yeah. Isn't it?
It's a great idea. I mean, knowing all about all those hellion kids that have been through that bus lot of, you know, Jeb was the one that was smarter than all of them.
Man, look at...
He would go at driver intros, too, and get them.
Hustle.
Yeah.
He had a hustle.
Yeah, it was good. A hustle.
At Michigan... Right after practice, Tommy said NASCAR wants to see you, and I'm still practicing. And the only reason they didn't stop me in practice because they were getting ready to end. Jeb and Mark Martin's boy were throwing water balloons outside the bus lot at some campers.
Oh my God!
And one old gentleman probably didn't think nothing of it. The balloon had hit his motorhome window, and he's saying they broke my window. So I get escorted out there and have to meet this guy, and of course he had a broken window, but I'm like, sir, there's no way in the world this water balloon broke the window. That went on. So I mean, it was no telling during the practice and all what the heck them kids would do doing, you know, and driving the golf carts and.
I bet he got his tail chewed on that one. What are you doing?
Well, listen, but this is why I love how much success he's having, because I mean, he is such a good guy and just such a hard worker, and you know, things that we do, like he and I are working on another project together, and he's the one that's calling me all the time saying, all right, where are we at with this stuff, you know? And man, I just love that about him, and I think that you raised him with that same work ethic, and you should be commended. And that's why I also think that you should be congratulated and feel good about his success. Because, man, when he wins that race this year at Talladega, my goodness, were you there?
No.
You were watching on TV?
I was in my basement because I can't watch it with my wife, particularly at Talladega and Daytona.
And
she's not as bad as Jeff's wife by no means. But
what was your reaction, though?
Well, every time that it rained, I lost two races at Darlington from rain, so I was a little concerned about the rain. But when I went upstairs to ask my wife, she was screaming. So the race had been called like a minute before I even could compute it with her screaming around the house. But, yeah, my good friend Chris Baines from Halifax County, he's one of the top maintenance guys at Daytona, and he got the phone to Jeb so we could say hey to him.
How was that?
But, man, I've been lucky. You know, my daughter, Sarah, I got two grandchildren. She just got a great job with the Martin Agency today for the second time because she's been raising kids. So Jeb has got a good work ethic. Ashton, you know, is in college and this crazy virus. Hope that'll school and be able to get back to same, but I've been lucky. My three kids, none of them are lazy.
Can you imagine if he had a lazy kid, how long that'd last?
He ain't not going to stay around the house too long.
He wouldn't have one, yeah.
No.
Well, man, it's been a great conversation, Ward. I appreciate you coming all this way to spend some time with us. People have been asking us to get you on this show for over a year now. They've been begging for you to come on, so they're going to be thrilled to hear you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me, and I think it's probably the longest we've talked, Dale, so let's let's stay in touch more, man. Yeah. All those things I said about you and your family, I really mean it. You've done a great job for the whole sport and for yourself, too, which is perfect.
Well, I've always appreciated you and thought the world of you, and just good to see you still out there. I follow along with your social media and keep up with you, and you seem like you're having a good time and enjoying your life. Things are going great with your family, like you mentioned, and we wish you the best.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Ward Burton on the Dale Jr. Download. Well, we finally made it to my favorite part of the show, Ask Junior, brought to you by Xfinity. Ask Junior, this is going to be different. We have questions submitted to Xfinity Racing on Twitter by drivers, right? Are these Cup guys, Xfinity guys?
Xfinity guys.
All Xfinity drivers. Well, I saw a couple Cup guys asking some questions, so I wasn't sure. But anyways, I love this. I can't wait to hear the questions that they have. And should be a lot of fun. I believe there'll be some smart aleck stuff in there because most of those guys got pretty good personalities. So let's have at it.
First question from Ryan Vargas. When you were a rookie in the Xfinity Series, how did you try to leverage expectations and prep headed to tracks you'd never been to?
Ryan is a super cool guy.
Yep.
I'm glad he chimed in. I knew he would. We had a deal a couple years ago. We were speaking to some of them young drivers, and he was the first one to come up to me after the conversation, introduced himself, so I've been paying attention to him ever since. But anyways, that's what you need to do. Do what Brian did. Introduce yourself to everybody you meet in the industry, and they'll start tuning in, paying attention to you. Anyways, the question was, what was the question?
When you were a rookie, how did you leverage like expectations and prep heading into tracks you'd never been to?
Well, I raced on iRacing when I was going somewhere that I'd never been to. Just run a lot of laps at that track, especially the road course stuff. You know, watching races, watching video, watching in-car camera, get an in-car camera of a driver who won or run well and watch his video and listen to his throttle and listen to see his steering, what he's doing, what he's fighting, and where he's lifting and things like that. I mean, that's all pretty straightforward stuff. I'm sure everybody's probably clued into already. In terms of expectations, I mean, you're just going to put so much pressure on yourself. You're going to have this idea of where you really think you need to finish, should finish. But basically, when we had practice, you could drive the car and go, okay, by the end of the, you know, by the time the race is starting, I think this car is, it can finish in X place, right? And if we finish better than that, that'll be good. If we don't finish as good as that, I'll be disappointed. That's how I usually did that. And I did that every weekend up through my entire career. I'd have an idea of where I thought the car could finish before the race started, and that would kind of be my target for being having some personal satisfaction or being happy about. Is that a word? Satisfaction.
It is now.
Being happy about what you did, right? Or being disappointed. So, anyways. You know, I don't know. I'm not going to give anybody advice, but that's basically what I did. Without practice, I don't know how you do that. I think maybe in the first 10 or 15 laps, you figure out what kind of car you got and start thinking about where you think you should finish. I just did that. I couldn't. It was a habit of mine that, you know, I did. And when when things go better than you expect, then it's a good feeling.
Next question from Chase Briscoe. You can run any car at any track, and that's
Chase
it.
Chase is a Cup guy.
See? That's right.
Well, I wonder if he's doing an Xfinity race. That's why
count.
He was able
doesn't
to.
Count.
Yeah, okay. Doesn't count.
Doesn't
count. If he's one, if he's
sorry,
a part-timer.
Chase. Yeah.
Nope. You can ask. I like. Right. I liked it.
I like this question.
Yeah, I do too.
You can run any car at any track, and that's it for the rest of your life. What do you pick and why?
Probably a late 70s car, maybe the Chevy Laguna, and probably... You know, there's a lot of tracks I'd love to go to once to try them, see them, Texas World Speedway and stuff like that. But probably old Atlanta.
Mm.
before the dog leg.
That's a good answer.
It looked like a lot of fun. I could run it the rest of my life. Yeah, late 70s, old Atlanta.
All right, next question from Jesse Little. What was the most recent book you read?
I think the Gary Ballou book is the last one I read. Hot Shoe. Maybe I've read one since then, but I think it was...
Will Cronkite?
Yeah, book? I did read Will's book. So I read Will Cronkite's book. He was a car owner in the Cup Series in the 70s and worked on race cars. Great book. Worked with dad, so there's a lot of that in there. So Will Cronkite's book and Hot Shoe, Gary Ballou's book. Two great books.
Two great racing
Gary's books.
Yeah.
Crazy. Next question from Tommy Joe Martins. Who was the guy that always raced you the hardest, but then was like buddy-buddy, no big deal outside the race car?
Matt Kenseth. So Matt, we were great friends, really good friends, and I'd like to think we still are great friends today. He gives me a hard time for not staying in touch with him, but I haven't gotten a text from him in a while either. But that's his sense of humor. But we get on the racetrack, and, you know, five laps to go, three laps to go, we could be running for 15th. And he will squeeze you off the corner. And I would go up to him. I'd be like, man, I had to lift, you know, and that cost me like three spots that last lap. Thanks. And he doesn't apologize for it. But, I mean, we would have a great friendship off the racetrack. But when you were on the track with him racing – He wasn't going to do you any favors. You better not expect any. He didn't race dirty, and he didn't run into me. But he was definitely racing, you know, for himself. Nothing wrong with that.
Stephen Parsons, what was the best fight you've seen at Hickory Speedway? Any fighting stories?
Ah, man, I think it was him and his dad. I think that's why he brought that up.
Oh.
So I was at Hickory watching Josh Berry race and William Byron. He used to race our late model. And somewhere along in the middle of the race, I guess he got in a little dust up on the track. And I mean, literally like three hollers down, there's Phil Parsons duking it out with some guy. They're wrestling around, just a little short little hustle. And it was funny, man, because I was, you know, you wouldn't think Phil Parsons would – let himself go to that space. He went to that place that night.
Phil did.
Yeah, he did.
Wow. That would be fun to watch.
I don't know. I've not seen many fights at the racetrack, but that was one I witnessed. It was quick, but it was aggressive.
All right. One more from Brandon Brown. When you raced road courses, did you change your hand positioning on the steering wheel, or did you still keep them together?
I need a watch. I think I probably kept them at, like, you know, 10 and 2. I need to watch because I don't know I'm doing it. I don't know really when I'm driving. I don't really pay attention to anything I'm doing. I don't do that, Mike. But on the ovals, he's talking about this. So Mark Martin used to do this. But when I turn the wheel, I move. Basically, I kind of drive like this on the straightaway. And then when I go into the corner, I move my right hand to my left, next to my left hand, and pull the car like this, steer the car like this in the corner, and then back to here on the straightaway. I mean, even at a short track, like over and over and over. And it just, I'm doing it unconsciously. But at the
unconscious. Uh-oh. That's trouble.
Subconsciously, what is the word I'm looking for?
Maybe instinctually.
Instinctually.
He's out, y'all. He's
out. I'm not unknowingly doing it. So anyways,
I know what you meant.
Yes.
Brandon Brown also had a question for Water Cooler Dale.
Oh.
He wanted to know, which was hilarious.
He's
who
awesome.
Who do you gossip about the most in junior motorsports? That was a question for Water Cooler Dale.
And we used to be Steven Steffen, because he was always giving us something to watch on the security cameras.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
He was always running into something, crashing something. Doing something that was going to end up on the end of the year video at Christmas party.
Martin, maybe?
Who do we gossip the most about?
I mean, Martin, anytime there's an IT failure, like our internet slows down and we go look for Martin, he's maybe on a sailboat.
Yeah. I don't know. I probably gossip the most. I mean, the most people that the most I talk about, the most person I talk about, the you know, is probably drivers. Like I'm always talking to Kelly or LW or Ryan Pemberton about our drivers, and it could be any of them. And then crew chiefs are right below that, right? Just trying to keep the harmony and what's going on, what guys need, what they need from me, how people are doing, what the people's attitudes have been, how this driver's doing, where's his head at, that kind of stuff. Great questions. Appreciate everybody. Appreciate all the Xfinity drivers being a part of this, man. You know, guys got things to do and they're busy. So thanks for chiming in. Thanks to Xfinity for supporting this part of the show. Ask Junior on the Dale Junior Download. Well, that part of the show seems to always go by too quickly, Mike.
Yeah, it does always seem to go too quickly, but not nearly as fast as Xfinity XFi.
Well, Xfinity XFi is more than just fast, Mike. It's also reliable and powerful, meaning everyone can do more of what they love with faster internet.
That it is. With Xfinity XFi, you can do more of what you love with faster internet. You and your crew, you can stay connected with Wi-Fi coverage. It delivers the speed your devices need. And remember, everyone, send your Ask Junior questions to @XfinityRacing on Twitter.
Before we hit the road, thank you, Xfinity, proud premier partner of NASCAR.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Brett Griffin is in the house making a guest appearance on the Dale Jr. Download, I think. And if you're listening, make sure you listen up.
Hey, this is TJ Majors, and we have a new episode of Door Bumper Clear out right now, breaking down the races from Sonoma and Mid-Ohio.
What's up? Freddie Kraft here. We talk Ross Chastain taking a shortcut, Ryan Preece pulling out on the track in front of everybody coming, AJ Allmendinger's three-wide restart move, and much more.
Including our crazy fans showing us lots of love on what started here on the DJD, but is now on DBC Reaction Theater.
That's my favorite part of the show, obviously. Go listen to Door Bumper Clear right now, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you sure that's your favorite part?
It's always my favorite part. It's been pretty good for me here lately. As soon as Joey nudges somebody, bumps somebody, we do something, it'll go right back.
So this week.
I hope it's for $1 million too.
Thanks to Ward Burton.
Love him.
Yes, Ward was great. I love that guy.
Yep.
He was awesome, and he straightened out a lot of things that Jeff had incorrect. I was really glad that he was able to come in here and straighten out some of that stuff that Jeff Burton was just kind of all over the place. Confusing.
That's not how I took it. I took it as whatever Jeff said.
I'm just so thankful that Ward come in here and set the record straight.
I think Ward looked at it as an opportunity to kind of mend some fences.
Yeah, Jeff just screwed things up sometimes.
So he's your colleague. Don't say that about him.
Anyways, you guys, I hope you enjoy the show, and we'll see you next week. This bit of badassery was made by Dirty Mo Media. Dirty Mo!